Hello and welcome to Fourth Estate, a show about journalism. We're coming to you from 2SER in Sydney on the Gadigal lands of the Eora Nation, right across Australia on the Community Radio Network and directly to your device across the globe via podcast. I'm Tina Quinn and it's a pleasure to have your company as always. This week marks 6 months since the latest outbreak of conflict between the Israeli government and the Palestinian people kicked off. It's a topic that does not make for polite dinner conversation and one which often triggers division and disagreement amongst even the closest of friends. It's heavily debated between political parties, academics, historians, and increasingly media institutions. In the space of half a year, more than 33,000 Palestinian civilians have been killed as the Israeli Defense Forces continue their military assault on the Gaza Strip. But it was the killing of 7 humanitarian workers by the IDF at the beginning of this month, which seems to have sparked a shift in tone, not just from our mastheads and outlets, but even some of our policymakers. Joining me to discuss this week is Anthony Lowenstein, an independent journalist, filmmaker and author of the best-selling and Walkley-winning book, The Palestine Laboratory, How Israel Exports the Technology of Occupation Around the World. His work can often be found in The Guardian, The New York Times and most recently Middle East Eye. He was based in East Jerusalem between 2016 and 2020. Welcome back to Fourth Estate, Anthony.
Thanks for having me on.
Political reporter for The Australian, Sarah Eisen, is also with us. She spent the last 5 years covering federal politics in the Canberra Press Gallery. A warm welcome to you, Sarah.
Thanks for having me on.
And another press gallery stalwart, Noor Haidar. Noor spent 7 years with the ABC, 4 of which as a political reporter in Canberra. She left the ABC at the beginning of this year and is now a co-host and senior producer of Guardian Australia's Full Story podcast. A warm welcome, Noor. Thanks for joining us on Fourth Estate.
Hi. Nice to join you.
So, Anthony, I want to start with you first. There's been many conflicts which have flared up over the years between Israel and the Palestinians. Which was the first one that you yourself covered as a journalist?
The first time I was in Palestine was 2005. I was there researching my first book, which came out in 2006, called My Israel Question. It wasn't particularly investigating a particular conflict beyond the occupation, which obviously is a daily grinding nightmare for Palestinians. But I first went to Gaza in mid-2009, which was 6 months after, I guess, the first round, you could say, of Israel-Hamas wars. Operation Cast Lead was the name that Israel gave it. And in mid-2009, there were vast, vast areas that had been destroyed. They were still bombed out. Of course, nothing compared to what we're seeing in the last 6 months. But Palestinian families were living in rubble. Essentially, I was there in the summer, in mid-2009, so their summer. And I've been to Gaza many times since in the last 15 years, and that was my first time, and it left a real mark on me because although Gaza has many problems, I'm not for a second romanticizing. It's actually a very beautiful place. People often don't think like that, but actually it is on the Mediterranean. So yeah, I guess the first post-war space I was in was 2009.
So your background is Australian-German and you're also Jewish. What attracted you to covering the Middle East and specifically this part of it?
I think you just answered the question. I mean, obviously, not every Jew is engaged with this issue, and it's probably fair to say still that, in my view, tragically, the vast majority of Jewish people and the Jewish community and the mainstream Jewish voices are militantly pro-Israel, I think disastrously so, for a range of reasons. I won't go into the whole story, but essentially when I was growing up in Melbourne, I grew up in Melbourne in the mid-70s and 80s, there was just a real contempt and hatred for Palestinians. I heard it all the time. I heard it in my family. I heard it through the Jewish community. I heard it in my synagogue. It's ubiquitous. And for a range of reasons, that really upset me. And when I got to university, I started learning much more about the conflict. Fast forward to 2003, when I came to Sydney from Melbourne, I had a traineeship with Fairfax. Fairfax is now Nine, but it was Fairfax in the time. And I started writing about this conflict. I mean, I'd never been to Palestine then. The first time, as I said, was in 2005, and realized pretty quickly that when I started writing about this issue, elements in the Jewish community, the self-appointed Jewish leaders, who are sadly predominantly, in my view, far right and largely racist, mostly men, and have a deep contempt for Palestinians and Arabs and Muslims, in my view, And that's been a moral disaster. Like a lot of my work in the last 20 years has not been about this issue. I've written about the wars in Afghanistan and the drug war and lots of other issues. But for a range of reasons, at the moment, of course, the big issue in the world, rightly so, is what's happening in Gaza. And I've been part of a growing movement of particularly, I'm not that young anymore, but younger Jews who are utterly disgusted with the mainstream Jewish position on this issue long before October 7, and are saying that there's a different, more humane Judaism. Although I'm not religious, I'm essentially atheist, but I'm proud of the cultural side of Judaism and believe that I do not want the mainstream community, which is predominantly not Jewish, to only hear Jewish voices that seem to say one message: bomb, destroy, kill, torture Palestinians. That is how most people see the Jewish community, which is utterly disastrous and, in my view, contributes to anti-Semitism. So I guess I want to be part of a movement which is growing globally that is far more critical and skeptical both of Israel, again, long before October 7, but certainly since, and closer to home. So yeah, it's the personal and the political on this issue, which has been often tricky. A lot of people hate me for it, but also I get some love. So it's been complicated.
So, look, you've kind of laid it out there. I was going to ask this. There's a common central narrative in how the media covers most issues. So, if you were to describe the one that's largely utilised by Western media over the last number of decades covering this conflict, I mean, how would you lay it out?
Pretty badly. Now, of course, there are good journalists, there's good outlets. I mean, it's hard not to generalize when we're having this conversation. But in general, the vast bulk of the mainstream media, not just in Australia, US, UK, Western countries, again, with some exceptions, have a deep contempt for Arabs, Palestinians, and Muslims. I'm not just talking even about Palestine. I mean, I think this was even bad before 9/11. And it's got way worse since. Yes, there are more voices that are from those communities now than existed 20 years ago. That's an undeniably good thing. But I think often the senior leadership of media organizations remains incredibly white. And I don't think being white automatically means that you're racist. Of course, it doesn't mean that. But too often that diversity is not reflected in the coverage. And we've seen in the last 6 months huge amounts of issues, scandals, controversies, and frankly, racism of someone who is not white, a person of color. It seems to be much more women than men, but obviously men can experience this too, of trying to silence more critical voices around Palestine. And the irony in all that is that despite, I think, often the media coverage being pretty terrible and blindly pro-Israel, because people often forget huge amounts of journalists and politicians go to Israel regularly on all expenses paid trips to their propaganda trips. And this has been going on for 20, 25 years. You'd be amazed how many journalists and politicians do that. They often don't want to talk about it that much publicly because I think it's pretty shameful and outrageous that they do it. And they spend about 2 seconds in Palestine at best, and they come back propagandizing for Israel. But despite that, public opinion actually is changing. So it's interesting how, and again, this is happening before October 7, that I think despite often a very blindly, what I would call pro-occupation, an anti-Palestinian narrative, which is prevalent in much of our media, much of the public in Western countries, actually, according to public opinion polls, are increasingly sympathetic to Palestinians. Again, before October 7, but certainly since.
Anthony, you touch there on the diversity aspect of all this, or maybe the lack thereof. Noor, you've just started at The Guardian in the last 2 months. Do you think having a more diverse team or a more culturally diverse team has improved their coverage of this issue?
Look, I have only been here with The Guardian now going on 2 months. So for, I guess, the months preceding that, and certainly during the period that this latest sort of round of violence really kicked off, I was still reporting for the ABC. As Anthony pointed out, there is certainly, I think, an issue in the way that newsrooms grapple with diversity, particularly when it comes to reporting on Israel and Palestine. I think we've seen, and it's been publicly reported, commentary by senior journalists, senior figures within the media industry that question whether or not diverse voices can be legitimate contributors to this conversation, particularly those voices that do provide a critique of Israel, and suggesting that, if you provide that perspective, that is a personal one driven by opinion rather than one that's driven by having an informed knowledge, a thorough and rigorous understanding of the region. And I think that is, I think, deeply disappointing. It's frustrating. I've, well before October 7th, sought to report on Israel, Palestine, and the way that intersects with Australian politics. So issues around apartheid, when Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International came out with their findings, I covered that and calls for the Australian government to shift its position on Israel in light of those findings. And the media, I think, didn't give particular interest or focus to really substantive bodies of work and evidence that were critical of the systems that were in place in Israel. And I think, obviously, in light of October 7, that has changed, but largely the conversation is still being had and mimics the language used by politicians in this country, most of whom are broadly supportive of Israel. And I think that dictates the parameters of the conversations that we have in Australia, where we are confined, unfortunately, to the language used by politicians who have repeatedly said that Australia will always be a close friend and a strong friend of Israel's, even though you've got human rights experts, international lawyers, experts, you know, building this body of evidence that there are egregious human rights abuses taking place in Israel. And I think an unwillingness to engage with that domestically. And unfortunately, I don't think the media has done collectively a strong enough job at really picking apart those positions held by our leaders, and in some ways have gone towards maintaining the status quo.
I think that's a good way of putting it as well. I mean, there are, particularly as a reporter in the press gallery, the reporting that I do is about what the politicians are saying. What is interesting in the last few days and weeks, I suppose, is that the view and the policy, I guess, towards Israel and this conflict has started to drift apart between the coalition and Labor. Obviously, Albanese has in recent days and weeks been very critical of the attacks on the aid convoys, while the coalition has been a little bit less so. And you're starting to see more and more of that drift apart, which is really interesting because in previous conflicts, whether it was what was happening in Afghanistan or at other times, when it comes to foreign policy, there's usually, at least broadly, that sort of bipartisanship on this. That's just kind of a rule of federal politics, I suppose. What's happened in recent weeks is seeing that begin to not be the case anymore. It's going to be really curious, I suppose, what that means as a reporter, as you are going to report on what the coalition and Labor are saying and prosecuting on this issue, when they might start becoming more and more different. I'm not sure what it's going to look like in coming weeks, but I imagine it will become quite politicized. I mean, there's going to be an election. There's already a lot of commentary about what this means during an election year and so on, and how that influences our politicians. So that's going to be really interesting to see how that plays out. This is all going to kind of come to a head when it comes to our political world as well, and what our two parties, or, you know, there's more than two parties. Obviously, the Greens, I think, particularly in the next few months, it's going to be interesting to see how that all plays out, given you've got the former Victorian Greens leader going for a federal Labor seat now. And that, I think, will also be a bit of a barometer on where things are at nationally with this conflict, what people think, what the parties do. And as I said, given that those two parties are in a more than ever kind of straying apart when it comes to their perception of at least the most recent events with this conflict, that's going to be quite interesting to see how that all takes place as a reporter, to be reporting on exactly that, what happens and what these two parties do ahead of an election year.
I guess one of the things that's very frustrating about so much of the media coverage around Israel and Palestine is that we are, and I obviously don't work in the Canberra Press Gallery, but we are too often deferring to politician says X or politician says Y. Now, obviously, if the Prime Minister says something, I'm not saying that we ignore that. You should cover it. But the problem with these sort of conversations is they too often say, well, this side says this and this side says that. And really, the public should just decide whatever they think is the right answer. I often use the analogy of reporting on South Africa in 1985 or 1990. I wasn't doing that. I'm too young. But can you imagine a reporter going to South Africa and saying, look, the white South Africans say apartheid's great and the blacks don't. Who's to say what's the truth? You read or decide. It's an absurd proposition because obviously that wasn't the case. The vast majority of journalists who would go to South Africa in 1985 or 1980 or 1990, unless they were white supremacists, would regard the apartheid regime as an abomination. I use that as an example because if the vast majority of journalists would go, and often do go, on Israel lobby trips to Israel, if you choose to open your eyes and see what is happening, not just in the five-star hotel the lobby puts you up in Jerusalem or Tel Aviv, but in Palestine, it is so blatantly and obvious apartheid. Now, obviously, there's a debate around this conversation. There's some people who disagree, sure. But this is not simply there's two equal sides, readers or listeners should decide. I mean, certain things are, I would argue, established facts. You have literally every single major human rights organization in the world saying so. You have the ICJ in the last 6 months, International Court of Justice, saying there's a plausible case of genocide happening in Gaza. There's obviously Israelis disagree with that, sure. But South African apartheid leaders disagreed with the fact that there was even anything wrong with apartheid until 1994 when it ended. My point being that this is not an issue that we should just be having two equal sides. There are some objective truths and facts. And the problem is that our media, not just here, same in the US and the UK, are so obsessed. I saw it even today on the front page of the Sydney Morning Herald. Yesterday's front page was Penny Wong calls for a two-state solution. The Jewish community is very concerned. Today's cover is Peter Dutton says that Penny Wong's speech is a disgrace. And it's the worst foreign policy speech in decades. That's the story. Okay, so why are we reporting it? I mean, not we, but why are we collectively as media reporting it like that? That's not how you report news, in my view. You don't simply say, well, the government says one thing, the opposition says another thing. Who are we to say what's true? Now, sure, Peter Dutton gave that speech, but the idea that you would give that kind of perspective, in my view, equal stature, ignoring, by the way, the fact, I know it's been sort of touched on here, we all know why there is a shift, at least in some sides of the political elite, because a white Australian woman was murdered. Now, tragically, absolutely, this is what happened to her is horrendous, but there's been 35, 40, 40,000 Palestinians who've been murdered in the last 6 months. Has the political needle shifted much when they were killed? No. Is anyone seriously talking about the fact that growing numbers of countries around the world are talking about potentially imposing an arms embargo? We have the same agenda where government says Australia does not provide weapons to Israel, and the media reports that as fact. In fact, that is simply not true. Australia has been providing for years key parts to the Israeli military that they're using in their planes over Gaza. That is a fact. Do not report as a journalist. Government denies that the Australian government provides weapons to Israel. It's not true. Don't do a both sidesism to this conversation. It's infuriating. I think that is why growing numbers of people regard our profession with contempt. They do. Ask any people in the public about how they view most of the media. They think we're absolute complicit fools. That's what the polling says. And there's a reason for that, not just in the Muslim community. You'd expect them in many ways because they see how much the media treats them with contempt. I'm saying the wider community.
Noor, to go to you, you resigned from the ABC at the beginning of this year, and you said that commitment to diversity in the media cannot be skin deep. Culturally diverse staff should be respected and supported even when they challenge the status quo. Look, there's a lot to be, I guess, read between the lines there in that statement. It was customarily very diplomatic. How hard has that been coming from a culturally diverse background, but working within institutions that are led by and largely built in the vision of white Anglo-Saxons?
I think in many ways it brings about frustrations because there is a view amongst many of my colleagues, unfortunately, that my cultural background or my religion undermines my reporting. And I think that that is something that we are yet to grapple with in the Australian media landscape, where we talk so much about the need to have diversity in newsrooms. And when that diversity challenges the way that we talk about particular stories, challenges the narratives that are reported, rather than listening to that and sitting with that and reflecting on why it is that we already report, and not just on this issue, but a whole array of issues, why we report on them in a particular way, whether or not that is coming from a position of bias on the part of those reporters. We tend to point fingers at diverse reporters and accuse them of, you know, bringing their opinion into it or failing to be able to report objectively. And I think that that is, you know, something that is deeply insulting because, quite frankly, I would say on this issue, there are a lot of people who have lived experience, a lot of people who have, well before October 7, put time and effort into researching and understanding Israel and Palestine, have sought to report on it rigorously and deeply outside of this, the intensity of what we're seeing. As Anthony pointed out earlier, the ICJ making the finding that there is a risk of a plausible genocide taking place at the moment. And instead of engaging with all the questions about human rights that predated October 7, I don't think the Australian media did a thorough enough job to question that, and indeed to put those questions to our political leaders who have for a long time held a bipartisan position of unwavering support for Israel. I recall when Morrison was still Prime Minister, and I believe it was Human Rights Watch that released their report saying that Israel had crossed the threshold and that it was there was a system of apartheid in place. The question was put to the Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, during the election campaign about whether it would make Australia reassess its close friendship with Israel. And his response was that no country is perfect and that Australia will always be a staunch friend of Israel. And I guess I wonder if we had put more effort into having a conversation then about our country's support for Israel, then we would be in a very different position now. And, you know, as Anthony also pointed out, it took the death of an Australian to elicit condemnation of Israel from the Australian government. It wasn't until close to 20,000 Palestinians had been killed that the Australian government began calling for a ceasefire. And so I think that that really demonstrates how much Israel has been able to get away with, despite, you know, a lot of evidence documented by journalists, spoken about by witnesses, Palestinian witnesses. And unfortunately, I don't think we in the West have done a good enough job at giving those eyewitness accounts by Palestinians as much weight as we do when the witnesses are white, or indeed when the victims are white. So there are a lot of things that we need to grapple with in the Australian media. But unfortunately, at the heart of that, I think, sits the unfortunate view that reporters who bring a diversity of perspectives on this issue are not capable of reporting on this in a fair and balanced way. And I think that that's deeply shameful.
Sarah, this week we heard from our Foreign Minister Penny Wong in regards to her support for a two-state solution. Now, we've discussed how and touched on the fact that this has been front-page headlines the last couple of days, and the centre of many opinion pieces, a number of which from your own masthead. Were her comments really altogether that breathtaking, though? I mean, she's been accused of creating a diplomatic row, but many of our allies have made similar comments. The UK's Foreign Secretary, David Cameron, the EU's Foreign Affairs Commissioner, Josep Borrell. Was what she said altogether that breathtaking?
I suppose, I mean, Australia's view is that it backs a two-state solution. It sort of said that, but I think whenever you talk about this, you always hear similar lines from the politicians of both parties. It's very, you know, generic. And as soon as someone puts it in a different way about recognizing Palestine or whatever, in a different way that people have done before, in a more clear way, or maybe some people felt it went a lot further than previous politicians. It, I suppose, because especially this issue is so at least divisive in some circles, it does raise a lot of eyebrows, and it becomes such a political fight so quickly, I suppose. In terms of the international comparison, I think that it is demonstrative of, I suppose, the increased concern there is with what Israel has done. And of course, we've already had a discussion of why now there is that concern after the attacks on the aid convoy. But after a few years of being in the press gallery and hearing about this issue spoken about long before October 7, like I said, you are used to politicians of all stripes saying almost exactly the same sort of line in exactly the same way. So it's in, and that's just often that sort of diplomacy. And you can point to how people talk about China in some ways as well, is it almost is like a script that people follow. So when people divert from that script, even just a little bit, it does, it's even tiny incremental changes in language are read into a lot. People, obviously, as Anthony said, they were on the front page of the papers. They will probably continue to be the next week. So yeah, even those tiny, tiny changes in language, in the Australian context at least, they've been made a lot of, for better or for worse, I suppose. And it's just going to be interesting to see where that takes us now, particularly, you know, the discussion of Hamas. I mean, Anthony Albanese has said he doesn't think Hamas has a place in the future of Palestine. The head of the Australian New Zealand Pacific pro-Palestinian network sort of said Hamas is part of the Palestinian people this morning. So again, that's going to also be a really big part of the discussion going forwards as well.
Anthony, I want to ask, how much does it frustrate you when you hear a broadcast journalist put to a Palestinian guest, oftentimes asking them over and over again whether or not they condemn Hamas?
A lot, because I'm looking forward to that same host or journalist asking someone who supports Israel, do you condemn the fact that Israel's potentially committed genocide against Palestinians? I'm still waiting for that journalist to actually ask that question. They don't ask that question. Of course they don't ask that question, and they won't. And I was often asked at the beginning, although of course I'm not Muslim, I'm Jewish, I was regularly asked as well, do I condemn Hamas? And so there's never that same response in return. And one thing I just wanted to say in relation to what Sarah was saying, it's almost like when he says how something is covered, we choose how it's covered. We are the media. We choose what gets covered. We choose. Now, obviously, I understand that I'm not the editor of a newspaper, or I'm not in charge of what goes on the, for example, the Guardian homepage. Of course, I'm not. But we have a choice of how we cover issues. We have a choice, unless we are doing the bidding of some other organization or individual. We have the choice of how we cover a story, how it's written, how it's framed. That is our choice. In other words, this is not sort of doesn't come down from the mount. That the way you tell a story, the way you write a story, as I said before, Anthony Albanese says this, Peter Dutton says this, who are we to decide? Now, I'm not suggesting every single news story should be an opinion piece. I don't think that for a second. But this issue of objective journalism is nonsense. It needs to be fair. And when you have roughly 1,100 to 1,200 Israelis killed, many of whom were soldiers, but many civilians, to be sure, on October 7, but potentially 35,000 Palestinians slaughtered, I'm still waiting for the media to really come to terms with that. And the idea somehow that the default position for much of the media when it comes to a inverted commas Jewish response is to go to the same four or five organizations who, by the way, all have exactly the same view on Israel. Does the media want to ask the question why? Why does every single mainstream Jewish organization say exactly the same thing about Israel-Palestine? There's no difference. Just have one organization, guys. It's going to be so much easier. Why go to the same voices? Most of them, by the way, are not elected. They're not representative. No one voted for them. So when the media, for example, in the Australian particularly, goes to certain lobby groups, particularly AJAC, which is the most arguably influential, it's privately funded that no one voted for. Why does their voice matter? I tell you why their voice matters, because when the media reports in a way they don't like, the media and journalists and editors spend years dealing with Israel lobbyists attacking them for a position they don't like. But don't give the people airtime. They don't represent anybody.
What I've noticed is a lack of critique of those organisations as well. So not only are we failing to, I think, adequately critique the position of our government, indeed the opposition, and our country's support for Israel, when we seek those voices from some of these Israeli lobby groups and pro-Israeli lobby groups, we're not questioning their position either. I just don't think it's tenable to elevate voices of an organisation that back on October 8 publicly tweeted that Gaza should be flattened. And I think that that is Astounding to me, because certainly I think if there was an organisation that was Muslim or Arab who suggested the same than other people, they would not receive any airtime, and they would be criticised, and their attitudes and their positions would be dissected thoroughly in the media. And that simply has not happened on this instance. I also wanted to make the point that journalists at every point of constructing a story are exercising decisions. Decisions that are influenced by, arguably, a bias, be it the framing, the headline, the choice of words, what is the lead sentence, what words do we choose to elevate, what do we choose to emphasise?
Well, on that issue in particular, we're seeing a lot of internal division within large media organisations, not just here in Australia, but across the world, about the specific language that's being used when it comes to reporting on this conflict. There was a report from a trade publication about a meeting which took place at CNN's London headquarters between management and staff. And one of their most senior journalists and anchors, Christiane Amanpour, expressed what she called her real distress about CNN's protocol of having reporting on Gaza sub-edited by the network's Jerusalem Bureau, which operates under Israel's military censor. So she spoke of copy being changed and what she called double standards. Now, that's just one example at one media organisation. We're hearing about similar meetings taking place with similar concerns being expressed at media organisations here in Australia. Do you think the dial is starting to shift? Is there a change underway?
The news organisations have changed, or the people who work for them is changing. It's hard to say. I mean, I don't really see much evidence, frankly, in Australia that the leadership that runs The Australian or the Sydney Morning Herald or The Age or, frankly, ABC is changing. I mean, there's no evidence for that whatsoever. What is changing, though, is that many within Nine and parts of the ABC are deceived by this. And it's worth saying for listeners who may not be aware that there was a number of petitions that were signed over the last months, particularly soon after October 7, a number of journalists signed from the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age and others. I signed it too, although I'm an independent journalist. And the Nine early editors basically were appalled and said, this is inappropriate and you cannot work on these stories on Israel-Palestine for 6 months, kind of ignoring the rather important detail, I would think, that some of them had been on literally all expenses paid trips to Israel. And there's a picture of the editor of the Sydney Morning Herald rolling around in mud at the Dead Sea. Seems pretty relevant to how people see these stories. And this goes to the heart of why so many, particularly younger people, they don't read the Sydney Morning Herald. They don't engage with the ABC, for better or worse. They just don't. And they're getting information, if they interested in information, from other sources, from other news organizations or social media, whatever it may be. And the idea somehow that essentially that kind of messaging says that certain biases is fine, our biases is okay, we're objective because we go on free lobby trips and roll around in mud. We're fine. But you little young journalists, you can't sign a petition. And by the way, those petitions were simply calling for fairer coverage. It wasn't calling, you know, for the downfall of Israel. It was saying, as Noor's been explaining very well, that often there is a reluctance to hear more critical voices, particularly of Israel. And really what it comes down to, let's be honest here, is Palestinian blood is seen as cheap. This is it. Jewish blood is seen as more valuable. This is it. It's racism. It's racism. It's not called racism, but that's what it is. It's racism. There's been 45,000 Palestinians dead. And yet the outrage in the UK and Australia and the US, in terms of the political elites, I mean, is when white aid workers get killed. And again, what happened to those aid workers is outrageous, obviously. But what does that tell you about the selective outrage? And again, it comes down to the key point. It's why public opinion is shifting despite media coverage, not because of it. There's a poll this week that found the majority of British people supported an arms embargo on Israel and the stopping of arms being sold to Israel from the UK. I guarantee if that poll happened here, it would have exactly the same response. That message is not coming from the media at all. It's coming from people getting that information and seeing mutilated bodies in Gaza and responding appropriately, that they're outraged.
I think also on the point of how this undermines our work, you know, certainly in amongst a lot of the people that I've spoken to over the last 6 months, and I guess, for a very long time in Arab and Muslim communities, there is a distrust of Western media organisations, and I would argue a legitimate distrust that comes from a concern around the way that Western organisations have reported on the Middle East, on people's homelands, on communities here domestically in Australia, that makes people doubt, question, and be a bit sceptical of the way that the media frames and writes about our communities and writes about the Middle East and Arabs around the world. And, you know, you can only look to the way that the Western media establishment reported on Iraq and the Iraq invasion at the time, and the way that that is now, I guess, broadly acknowledged as something that should not have happened. There are a lot of people who have felt red hot anger over the last few months and have felt that the media has failed to reflect, grapple with their grief and the scale of death in Gaza. And I think that that is unfortunately going to mean that people are going to turn away from organisations that have the resources or should at least be putting effort into doing thorough and comprehensive journalism. And at a time that we talk about, you know, a declining trust in media, I think we've done ourselves a very big disservice over the last few months in minority communities here in Australia. The other thing I would point to about how newsrooms are changing or not, certainly, yes, I think there are people inside organisations, predominantly younger journalists, who are trying to shift the dial. I myself took part in meetings around that during my time at the ABC. And I would say that everything that I contributed wasn't coming from a place of opinion. I was encouraging people to follow the weight of evidence, and that was, I think, a very reasonable thing to ask. I thought context was really important, and I think that we should all be trying to bolster our journalism and make sure that it is as rigorous as it possibly can be, particularly when we know that there are many people watching and attempting to critique it and pull it apart when it comes to Israel and Palestine. And one thing that I've been reflecting on is Antoinette Latouf's case and her sharing a post by Human Rights Watch about starvation being used as a weapon of war. And that was only back in December that she was released from her position, fired, dismissed. I'm not sure what the terminology is that's being used in the courts at the moment. But that language, I wonder, nowadays is being used prominently by members of our parliament. You have ministers saying that what Israel is doing, quote, is not a war. You have people publicly saying that Israel is engaging in indiscriminate targeting of Palestinians. It was controversial in December. Why? Just because politicians disputed it? Politicians who are publicly supportive of Israel? I guess for me, I'm just disappointed, and I find it frustrating that we allow politicians to set the parameters of the conversations that we're having on this issue when we don't necessarily, and our job is actually to critique that and to scrutinize that rather than to adhere to it. And I think the last 3 months at least have shown that we probably haven't done a good enough job at holding our leaders to account on this issue. I know in the past we've had politicians refer to reports by Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International when it comes to, say, human rights abuses in Myanmar or human rights abuses in Xinjiang in China as credible sources, and then dispute those findings or diminish the findings when they're made about Israel. And so where is this double standard coming from? And are we as journalists doing a good enough job at, I guess, picking apart the language used by our politicians and, I guess, exposing those double standards and hypocrisy when it comes to this issue? Because human lives are at stake.
See, we can't say one thing in response to that. That when Noor talks about our job as political reporters or journalists should be holding power to account, of course she's right. But I would argue, as I have for years, that most journalists don't see their role like that at all. They definitely don't see their role. If you ask them face to face, they'll say, of course, I'm holding the powerful to account.
Well, many would argue that that is a position of advocacy, not journalism. And those two things are separate, especially, you know, I speak to a lot of journalists who I guess you would, you know, consider them, and they would consider themselves part of the old guard, who would very strongly prosecute that position.
Well, good on the old guard for saying that. But the fact of the matter is that if your job is to, if you believe that your primary job is to say, the government says this and Peter Dutton says this, and there we go, that's a new story for you. Really? Is that actually what you think your role is? That's literally stenography. That's actually not journalism. That's stenography. And the vast bulk, and I've said this for years, not just because of Israel-Palestine, the vast bulk of journalism, in my view, that comes out of our mainstream media is literally rewriting press releases. That is what it is. Not all of it. Obviously, there's good journalists doing good work. Of course there are. But the vast bulk of it on lots of issues is literally rewriting press releases. That's what the job is. That's it. And if you ask most journalists, are you holding power to account? No, they're enjoying being close to power. That's what most journalism has become. Not just at the Murdoch Press, which is not really a news organization. In my view, it's essentially a propaganda unit for the Liberal Party, has been for years. I'm not just talking about Dan. I'm talking about in a much wider sense that too many journalists, in my view, think that the way you go far, which sadly is often true, is not holding power to account, because then your career might be negatively impacted. There are exceptions. Obviously, there are good journalists doing good work. But I think too often what journalists see their role, and again, not just about Israel-Palestine in general, is to basically bolster power, be close to power, schmooze with power. That is not what journalism is, in my view, should not be. But sadly, for many journalists, that's what it is.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there, unfortunately. I'd like to thank our guests on Fourth Estate this week, Anthony Lowenstein.
Thanks for having me.
Sarah Eisen.
Thanks for having me on.
And Noor Haidar.
Thanks, Tina.
And thank you for listening to the program. This edition was recorded at the studios of 2SER and heard across the country on the Community Radio Network. Fourth Estate is produced with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. A big thanks to the foundation for their continuing support. Make sure you subscribe to Fourth Estate on your favourite podcast app so you can hear us talk about media, politics and a lot in between. We'll be back with more next week, of course, but in the meantime, you can stay in touch with us on Twitter. Our handle is Fourth Estate AU. I'm Tina Quinn. Thanks for listening. Stay well, stay safe, and catch us next week on Fourth Estate.